Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who would you be if you were educated in the finest schools and raised in a mansion, but born to the woman paid to scrub its floors? American-born Olivia Salazar and her mother, Carmen, moved into the home of a Los Angeles talent agent and his family when Olivia was just 3 years old. Carmen, a documented immigrant from Mexico, was hired to keep the house clean, do laundry, and help raise the Smiths family's children. They learned Spanish from Carmen and showed a certain kind of respect for her that they didn't afford their own parents. Olivia not only played with the Smith kids like a sibling, she attended the same private schools and sometimes the same parties. The Smiths insisted Carmen and Olivia were like members of the family, but from a very early age, Olivia understood there were limits to that relationship that did not apply to the Smith children, and she grew up resenting the Smiths' growing attempts to control her personal life and was confused by her own search for an authentic identity. Mary Romero is professor and faculty head of justice and social inquiry at Arizona State University. Her new book is called The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. Mary, welcome to Think.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is such a fascinating, such a complex story and brings so many important questions and issues to light. That said, did you imagine when you first met Olivia as a young adult in 1986 that it would take you 25 years to do this story justice?
I had no idea. I'm not sure I would have started if I had imagined such a task was ahead of me. But I'm really glad that I did take the time to do it because it really allowed me to capture the complexity of a life and the complexities of her growing up and coming to terms with her experience and who she is.
Yeah, because there's things that she could understand about her own life at 45 that didn't yet make sense to her when she was 25.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. How did she come to share her story with you?
We were attending a conference in El Paso, and I had been presenting work from my first book, Made in the USA, M-A-I-D, and she came up to me after the presentation and asked me what other writings I knew about Mexican-American women working as domestic workers. And so we started to a letter exchange, and then the following year I met her at the same conference, and at that time she caught me in the lobby, and she asked to talk to me. We went off to a corner, and she began this incredibly emotional story, which she obviously had not told before.
Mm. So what arrangement did Carmen Salazar have with the Smith family? And is Smith the pseudonym, by the way,
in
this book?
Yes, it
is. Okay, all right. What arrangement did she have with them when she and Olivia first went to live in their house?
Well, first when they started living there, she was doing their laundry and working a couple of days a week. The family could afford to give her room and board and pay her a small salary for work a couple of days, but not for a full-time maid. So consequently, she went out into the neighborhood and worked as a day worker for the neighbors.
And that's a fairly common practice in places where people have live-in maids. They often will have them work a couple of other places during the week.
Yes.
Okay. From Carmen's perspective at the time, was this a good job?
Yeah, definitely it was, because it provided her a home for herself as well as her daughter. She could keep her daughter with her. So it was important. And it also provided the safety that she wanted for her child.
One of the first things that very young Olivia came to terms with was the difference, or had to come to terms with, was the difference between how her mother treated her and how she treated the children she was paid to care for. And there was, in fact, a distinct difference. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. Olivia's watching the Mrs. Smith engaging in a lot of conversation and a lot of caretaking with her own children, and she doesn't receive that same type of treatment from her own mother, of course, because her mother is constantly working all the time. And even when she goes back at the end of the day working for another employer and she goes into the Smith's home, she doesn't simply go into a room and close the door, but rather she starts picking up and helping with dinner, and her work continues the rest of the evening. So she doesn't really have the time to engage in this kind of parenting that Olivia sees Mrs. Smith engaging in. She also sees her mother tolerating types of behavior that she knows that would never be tolerated if Olivia tried to engage in any of these activities. Such as being sloppy, such as disagreeing all the time, smoking pot, drinking, or any activities like that.
And in many ways, for Carmen, the Smiths' approach to parenting and the response and the results of that served to reinforce the very different strategy that she took with Olivia.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She really wanted Olivia to learn by seeing the mistakes that other people make. I think she also realized that if she had her daughter with her, the employers were not going to tolerate a difficult child. Mm-hmm. So she really, and she could not take the time to negotiate instructions with Olivia because she needed someone who was going to be self-sufficient.
It's a lot of pressure on a small child, even if it's not spoken in such a way that if you, sufficiently misbehave, you and your whole family can be out on the street all of a sudden.
Right. And I think she sensed that her mother's position could be jeopardized if she acted out to a certain degree. I mean, there's so far she could push the boundaries.
You know, so many times when you read adult accounts of people who have grown up in poverty in particular, they don't realize until a certain age that the rest of the world doesn't work this way. It was very different for Olivia because she's living in this fancy home with children who have everything they want, with a mother who doesn't have to work and, in fact, has additional help. How did those differences strike her as a child in recognizing that there was another way to be, but it wasn't entirely available to her?
Well, there were actually three places that she learned what life was like living in poverty. One was, of course, that the maids in the gated community got together on a regular basis. They exchanged stories, which included the hardship of trying to bring over their children from Mexico, being apart from their children, the difficulty of money and so forth. There was also trips to San Fernando Valley and later other places in Las Vegas to visit their friends from Mexico who were working there. So she realized how different her life was from them. For instance, when she went to visit her friends in Los Angeles, instead of being separated by floors and different bedrooms and everything, you know, they accommodated the extra people at home by everybody sleeping together on the floor. And so everybody engaged in the same kind of activity, going to the laundromat, doing the laundry. That type of work wasn't delegated to just the women or maids, but everybody engaged in it. So she really got this different sense of how things could be done. Of course, the most prominent example or impact in her life was her summer trips to Mexico, where she would spend time with her family. And sometimes she would go back to small little towns where her great aunt was living in complete poverty. And she would see sort of the simple happinesses that they felt and the enjoyment of sitting around and telling stories and everything. And she did have a ability to romanticize this type of poverty. But she also saw that clearly they didn't have the kinds of resources that the Smith family or the other employers had, and she worried about her great aunt. You know, was she getting enough money to buy food, and what was she eating all year round when her mother was not visiting and bringing her clothes and bringing her food?
Another really interesting identity issue that Olivia dealt with was that when she was in Los Angeles, she could look at herself and compare herself to these wealthy kids with whom she shared a home and see them as spoiled and overprotected and everything else. Meanwhile, when she would go to Juarez or her family's home, they looked at her and said, "What a spoiled American you are, and you need to start helping out a little more." And that must have been difficult for her to hear when she saw how different her life was than that of the Smith kids.
Yes, she went through this transition. In Los Angeles, she was the ideal child. Everybody commented her mother for what a wonderful child she had, whereas when she went home, all of her relatives complained about what a spoiled brat she was. She should be helping her mother, and she should be doing work and engaging in more of the female traditional work of house cleaning and doing laundry and cooking and so forth, which Olivia tried to stay as far away as possible.
Yeah, she was very conscious of not ever wanting to sort of open that door for herself to domestic servitude.
Right. Mm-hmm. However, she did do other activities in the neighborhood. As a very young girl, she did get jobs babysitting employers' children, walking the dog, and later working in an ice cream shop.
It's kind of an amazing perspective she had, and in so many ways, this is a scholarly work, but it reads, the story's a little bit like a novel, because she had an amazing perspective because she could so easily sort of code shift from this upper middle class and wealthy lifestyle back into the perspective she and her mother shared, and people tended to pour their hearts out to her.
Yes, and she did a lot of emotional labor. I mean, having done the research on domestic workers and knowing that that was a common trait in their experiences of especially stay-at-home mothers who are lonely and wanting and dying for somebody to talk to that could really understand them other than, you know, small doing children talk to their small children. She also found herself being approached by the employers and wanting to discuss their children's problems with her and getting advice as to what they should do and expecting her to be provide companionship to them.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Carmen and Mrs. Smith? Because while in some ways it was confusing to Olivia, again, even as a small child, she was in many ways better able to understand the nature of this relationship than perhaps Mrs. Smith was herself.
Yes. It was a very important relationship. I think they were friends. They were very close. But Carmen also recognized the fact that she didn't want Mrs. Smith to know everything about her. She didn't want Mrs. Smith to have that kind of control over her. I don't think Mrs. Smith ever realized the kind of entrepreneur that Carmen was and the kinds of activities she was engaged in to make money for herself as well as to help other Mexican immigrant women. For instance, when she would meet with the women in the neighborhood, she developed what I guess some people might call a pyramid where everybody gave some money and then everybody would take turns getting the pot. And she would determine whose need was most important and so forth and make sure that it was regulated and fair. She also, when new neighbors would move into the gated community, she would go over and interview them as to what their needs were so she could place someone mm-hmm. there. So her relationship to Mrs. Smith was very important because she wanted to know as much about the neighborhood as possible so that she could prepare other workers in case there was going to be a divorce and they might lose their job or there might be a job opening and she knew someone who needed a job. And her relationship with Mrs. Smith was also important because she realized that Mrs. Smith could provide Olivia with access to opportunities that she obviously could not. And so she obviously did not want to, you know, ever strain her relationship with Mrs. Smith. She never told Mrs. Smith what she felt about her parenting practices or the leniency in terms of drugs, alcohol, or anything of that sort. So it was very complicated. And so Olivia saw both sides of this, and she never knew quite, you know, is this friendship or is this just an employer?
Mary Romero is my guest. She's professor and faculty head of Justice and Social Inquiry at Arizona State University. Her new book is called The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor and faculty head of justice and social inquiry at Arizona State University, Mary Romero. Her new book is called The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I have to tell you, Mary, I loved reading about the sort of double life that Carmen had that was concealed from the wealthy residents of the community where she lived. Because although she was absolutely considered by everybody to be the maid that they wished they had hired for their own families, she was still in their minds just a maid. Whereas within her own community and absolutely within her own extended family, she was considered not just a leader, but a sort of sage.
Yes, she was very smart and she was very assertive, and she knew how to create opportunities. She could see opportunities where other people could not.
So let's talk about the Smiths' involvement in Olivia's education. I think from the outside, for people who didn't think about this from Carmen's and Olivia's perspective, it would appear as if these people were just incredibly generous and they took on the responsibility for the education of their maid's daughter. But this is not, in fact, exactly how it worked.
No, what they did was they allowed Olivia to get registered in the same school as their children were attending a private school. And that obviously was not something that Carmen had access to. And they paid the tuition, but they really did not, because instead of paying Carmen for the work that she was doing, they paid the tuition.
Mm-hmm.
So it appeared as if they were paying her tuition to go to school. And that kind of decision that they made to bypass Carmen and to use the money that she was would have been earning to pay for the tuition allowed them more discretion in having a parenting role with Olivia. And for instance, early on, they made a decision about the kinds of courses that she would take. And Olivia resented it very much, and she wanted to see her mother play a stronger role in that. She also kept track in her mind, as she changed schools, the difference in tuition. Mm-hmm. And she recognized that the Smiths never renegotiated their business arrangement with her mother, and she resented that her mother was continuing to work so much and yet not receiving any salary.
It's an awful bargain in some ways as well, because although I guess Carmen was relatively happy working for the Smiths, having them tied so deeply into her daughter's education once it had been started meant she really almost couldn't look for a job that had a better deal or better benefits or better pay.
Right. And I think that there's an incident that's very important in Olivia's life, and I think in her relationship with her mother, that sort of continues as a constant tension in their lives that comes to the surface when Olivia is 10 years old and her mother is hospitalized and has to stay in the hospital for about a month during the summer. So Olivia doesn't go home that summer. Instead, the employers take it upon themselves to treat Olivia like a middle-class child, and the way they would treat a middle-class child is to protect her from her mother's illnesses, whereas, you know, her working-class relatives expect her daughter, regardless of how young she is, to at least be there with her mother and provide the companionship. But instead, Olivia, not having really any control over, is taken to vacation in Malibu and special classes in summer school and so forth. And she has a wonderful time, and she spends more time with the Smiths. And during that time, they also move her upstairs to sleep in one of their daughter's rooms who has left to college. So this move, and I don't think they recognize it at the time, places her mother and the daughter in totally different places and status position within the house. So Olivia is no longer sleeping in the maid's quarters with her mother. And when Carmen returns home from the hospital, she understands, okay, I may need to spend some time alone sleeping in this one bed that we have in the maid's quarter, but she doesn't want it to be a permanent situation because she sees a threat there that the employers are attempting to buy her daughter's love, and her daughter, of course, is very excited about having her own room and having it painted by the other brothers and sisters of the Smith's sons and daughters. And her mother sees her as wanting to be one of the Smith's children. And Olivia later, as she grows older, sees her mother constantly working, accuses her mother wanting to spend time with the employers rather than spending time with her. Hmm. So there is that tension throughout their lives.
Yeah, and it seems so, you know, natural that a 10-year-old offered, you know, her own room, having less for her to do with being with her mother or not than having her own space for the first time. She would want this, and yet she was always aware that this hurt her mother's feelings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Always aware that. And she wanted to spend more time with her mother, and as she got older, she resented that the only time that she had to spend time with her mother was when she was exhausted and she was tired. And when they did attempt to do something, they'd go to the movies, her mother would fall asleep out of exhaustion. And so she resented that, you know, she only got her mother after she was so tired she couldn't work anymore.
And on the other hand, you know, there were things that Mrs. Smith understood about the way schools worked and about how to sort of advocate for Olivia when there was an issue with a teacher that her mother didn't get. And Olivia may not have been comfortable with it, but she did turn to Mrs. Smith when she had a question about homework or things like that.
Yes, her mother really did come from the old school that, you know, the teacher is always right and a teacher should be respected. Whereas Mrs. Smith did not come from that school and was willing to question the teacher and trying to always find the best learning experience for the child. So it was much more individualistic than, you know, sort of a communal approach to learning.
Did Olivia ever tell you that there was a moment in her life where she sort of fantasized about really being the Smith child, or was that always something she knew was impossible and not desirable for her?
She never wanted it, or she never admitted it to me. And I saw she wanted to have the experiences, but she was never, ever willing to give up her mother.
Mm-hmm.
She was never willing to give up her family in Mexico. And she was never really willing to give up her Mexican identity or culture. And these are things that she grew up feeling that she had been denied that experience, the fullness of that experience.
And as she got older and started, you know, got into high school and started wanting to date boys, the Smiths felt that they had a right to guide her in those choices.
Right. They expected her to marry into their community.
Mm-hmm. You know, clearly they were misguided, if not just overtly racist in their many of their thoughts. Does Olivia believe they thought they had her best interest in mind?
I think her perspective was that they thought she was wrong. They thought that her culture was not as good as theirs.
Uh-huh.
That what she wanted was going to end up a disaster. There was going to be a destruction at the end because there was no way that if she didn't assimilate and attempt to become middle class that she could possibly achieve. So the only Mexican-Americans that were really in their lives were the maids in the neighborhood, the landscapers. That was their view of who these people were, and they didn't know them as leaders in the community. They didn't know them as entrepreneurs. They knew them as helpers.
How did Olivia sort of advocate for herself in order to be transferred to another private school, but one that had a much more ethnically diverse population?
Well, they refused to allow her to move, and she decided, okay, I'm going to just start failing classes, and she did, and so they realized that she was very serious about this,
mm-hmm.
and they negotiated that if she raised her grades that they would allow her to move to a parochial school where there was much more racially diverse student body. And she was able to get all of her grades up except one. And because she appeared to be such a inconsistent student, they had some difficulty finding a school for her. But through their network, they were able to get her in by talking to various people that they knew to contact the nuns and the archdiocese and so forth, and they were able to get her into school.
And ultimately, when she was in a place, pardon me, where she was happy, she returned to being an excellent student.
Yes, she did.
What did, in her previous school, what did her teachers, what did her classmates know about her unique situation?
As far as I can tell, she spoke about it. I mean, they were aware that her mother was, some of the children knew that her mother was a maid, and in some cases, her mother worked for them. And her mother was known as the ideal maid in the neighborhood, and so when children would introduce her to their parents, their parents couldn't quite figure out who she was until it was said, "Oh, you're Mrs. Smith's maid's daughter."
Hmm.
She resented being tied as if she was a possession, and her mother was a possession of Mrs. Smith, so she could never be just her Carmen's daughter. And early on, she also, the kids were confused why she always got into different lines for getting rides home. And, of course, she had to keep track where her mother was working on the various days so she knew what carpool line to get into to go home that day. And so people were a little bit confused as to, well, why you keep changing these. So there was some confusion, and I think there was some jealousy as well among the various employers' children who wanted to claim her as one of their family.
I know that you didn't, for various reasons, interview the Smiths during the course of your research. Is it your sense that they felt they were doing something philanthropic?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Very much so. I think that they saw that she was very attractive, and she was very witty, and she was very smart, and I think they did more because of that than they would have done for another child. And then there was also the point that she ended up being more successful than their own children. So in the long run, they started to have an investment in being able to claim her success.
You have an extraordinary scene toward the end of the book after Mr. Smith has died and Olivia and Carmen return for the funeral. Can you tell us a little bit about that incident?
Yeah, this was a pretty traumatic experience for Olivia. After she attended the funeral and attended the wake, she called me and asked to come and visit because she really wanted to get away and think about these things without the family and so forth. And
she was, excuse me for interrupting, she was an adult by this time.
She was an adult, yes. And it was very emotional 3 days. And I saw her really trying to come to grips with the information that she had acquired during that visit. What she acquired was she and her mother expected to attend the funeral. She didn't want to go, but her mother insisted that she go with her, so she did. They entered the chapel. They sat together, and immediately Olivia was taken to go sit with the family and to walk in with the family. And so she was surprised at that she was separated from her mother like that, and she hadn't really seen many of the Smith's children or for many years. And some of the friends of Mr. Smith gave their condolences to her, but not to his children.
Hmm.
And so she was quite surprised and began to realize that Mr. Smith must have spoken about her to his friends much more than she had ever imagined. And then to her shock, she discovered that her name was being placed on the tombstone as one of his children. And her mother was just mentioned as a longtime friend.
I mean, there's so much wrapped up in that. First of all, I mean, did this confirm for her that they had, in fact, loved her, even if they'd made some poor choices with regard to her? Or did it make her feel once again like something they were showing off? Can you talk about sort of the complex spin of emotions?
Yeah, And I think this is why it was so traumatic for her. On one hand, she'd always wanted to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted him out of her life. And she felt that everything they did was very paternalistic, and they were always expecting this enormous amount of gratitude, and she wanted to deny them that gratitude because part of that gratitude meant denying all the hard work that her mother had done.
Mm-hmm.
So she really wanted her mother to be recognized for these years of working in that community and the long hours that she put in and the ways in which they had taken advantage of her need to work and so forth. So when she discovers that these people are claiming her as one of their kids, she starts to sort of rethink, well, you know, how could they maintain these racist feelings about Mexicans and at the same time want her to be part of them? It was very complex for her to understand. And she also knew that Mr. Smith never agreed with her Democratic politics. He was a Republican and at one point even told her, "I can't believe you got all this education so you could use it against us."
Yeah, she was demonstrating and getting involved in sort of civic events.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so she had to reflect back on that, on how complicated this relationship was. And then I think she finally walked away with it sort of feeling like, you know what, I have nothing to lose here. I can give that to them.
Mm-hmm. Mary Romero is my guest. She's professor and faculty head of justice and social inquiry at Arizona State University. We're talking this hour about her book, The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mary Romero. She is professor and faculty head of justice and social inquiry at Arizona State University. Her new book is called The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Kim in Denton. Hello, Kim.
Yes. I have a question, Ms. Romero. I am myself Mexican-American and Nicaraguan, and I'm curious as to how fair-skinned Olivia was, because I can't believe that the Smith family would have taken her in unless she were able to pass at least as partially Anglo-American. And I'll take the response off the air.
Thanks for your call.
She was much more light-complected than her mother, and I think I've seen some of her class pictures, and she doesn't really stand out in the same way as a dark child would.
Did she sense that that was partially behind the Smiths' interest in her welfare?
No, I don't think so at all. I think early on, her focus was very much on culture and ethnicity and her Mexican culture, because although she was born in the United States, she spent her first 3 years in Mexico with her relatives, and her first language was Spanish. And so when she went into the sort of employer's world at the age of three, she had to learn English, and that was very difficult for her. And she realized that, you know, they were making fun of her when she didn't pronounce words very well, and she was never rewarded for her ability to speak Spanish. So for her, she saw this fact that they were trying to change her and take away her language as a rejection of who she really was.
And yet the Smiths insisted when she wanted to learn French when she entered school, they said, no, you need to study Spanish. And their rationale was, we want you to study perfect Spanish, like the Queen of Spain. Again, it sounds like a rejection of her Mexican heritage.
Exactly. And there was always sort of this rub that, you know, you're not upper class Spaniard. You are from Mexican immigrant stock.
Hmm.
And therefore, they don't speak the Queen's Spanish. And that was a story that she told many, many times over the years because it really irked her that they would say that.
How good was the Spanish of the Smith kids after being raised for all of them lived at least a decade with Carmen in the house?
They were not fluent.
Mm-hmm.
They could understand bits and pieces, and they knew how to use simple phrases, but they never became fluent.
And one of the Smith girls would only speak to Olivia, or really only use the Spanish that she did know, when they were around other Mexicans.
Yes, and that really shocked Olivia. And that particular incident that she describes, she's taking the bus home with one of the Smith daughters, and they get on the bus, and the bus is filled with Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans or Latinos. And Smith's children never speak to Olivia in Spanish. And in that particular situation, she begins to speak to Olivia in Spanish, but giving her directions and instructions, like to sit down and let's go, and not really a conversational Spanish. And Olivia thought it was strange, and she, you know, wondered if the Smith child was trying to let the Mexican Spanish-speaking people on the bus know that she could understand what they were saying, or, you know, exactly what she was doing. But it was real clear that the way she was speaking to Olivia, she was making it clear that she was in charge of Olivia.
So Olivia is in her late 40s now. She's a successful professional. She has children of her own. How does her experience as a child influence the way she parents her own kids?
She's taken a mixture of both Mrs. Smith and her mother's.
Mm-hmm.
She's certainly has very strict boundaries for her children, but she sends her children to private schools, and she does engage in a lot of discussion with her children about what they're doing in school. But she also won't think twice about grounding them for doing something that they're not supposed to be to do.
Did it take her a while to be comfortable with the fact that she had been influenced by her life with the Smiths to nearly the same extent as by her life with her mother? Whether she wanted to choose things from those experiences or not, they were part of who she was.
Right. I think in college she started to recognize that she always seen it as, had defined it as a negative experience. And in college, she started to see that these skills were useful,
mm-hmm.
and they could be used for political activism or anything that she wanted to. They were skills that she could use as she wished, not how the Smiths wanted her to use them. And so she started slowly starting to recognize that she had been influenced by them and that it was not all bad.
Well, it's so interesting because college must have been the first time that she got to choose how she presented herself to the world as opposed to having to sort of negotiate the things that had been set in front of her.
Right. And moving out of the gated community was very important. She wanted, of course, to completely leave that part of her life out, but she was not allowed to do that because her mother continued to work in the gated community, and if she wanted a relationship with her mother, she had to continue to enter into that world. But at school, she didn't tell anybody about that side of her life. Very few people ever knew. Just a few of her very, very best friends and a few professors knew about that. And so for the most part, the employer's children who were college students at the same university, they played along with it and pretended that they didn't recognize her, know her.
Hmm.
However, at times, they would decide to approach her and talk to her about that, which, of course, made her very uncomfortable because it's like somebody passing. You can't go back and forth between one community to the other. So she had to be very guarded.
Is Carmen, who's in her 80s now, still living in Olivia's
yes.
home?
She's living with her daughter.
Yeah. I thought it was fascinating when Olivia, it occurred to her that her mother, in some ways, acted in the role of maid, even living in her own daughter's home.
Yes. And it really bothered her, and she tried to change it, but she's finally come to grips with that's who her mother is. She's not going to change, and she just has to accept it.
It has to be, obviously they are bonded and close and experienced so many things, at least in a parallel way, if not in the same way, during those years that Olivia was growing up. But is there a chasm between them based on the amount of education that Olivia was able to have as compared with the very little that Carmen was able to get?
Well, interestingly enough, Olivia came to realize exactly how much cultural capital her mother had also obtained through her experiences.
Hmm.
And since Olivia is also engaged in a lot of binational kinds of public relations work, her mother's constantly keeping up with the news from Mexico and reading in Spanish and so forth helps Olivia to a large extent. She's also helped Olivia in reminding her what employers she might encounter in some of her activities or who she might be able to count on. And her mother has certainly been instrumental in her ability to host enormous parties and banquets and to do those kinds of business situations. So she finds herself laughing that her mother can sort of go toe-to-toe with her on political issues and some of these things, regardless of how removed she might be.
It is interesting, yeah, excuse me for interrupting, that this list of contacts that Olivia was able to enter the professional world with despite being raised the child of an immigrant domestic servant.
Right.
Talk about this. Mary, do we know how many children in this country are in a situation similar to the one that Olivia grew up in?
Well, I don't think there's many because I really don't believe there's many employers that want that extra person to bring a family member into their home.
Mm-hmm.
It causes discomfort. I did, in my interviews, I did run across one other person who was a law student at Stanford, and his mother had worked for an employer, and he was raised in the employer's home. But in the same situation, the employer could not pay his mother full time, so she did day work, and they were just able to provide lodging, which was important to the mother because she was able to send her son to the school in that area. But it's a very unique experience. What I found quite meaningful about her story, and this sort of has larger in terms of sort of how it impacts, says about larger society, is the way in which people attempt to negotiate race, class, and gender interactions on a one-to-one basis is not that much different than the way we do it on a larger basis in terms of determining public policy.
Hmm.
And one story of hers that really had an impact on my thinking in terms of this was her discussion about where she would eat on the holidays. And she, of course, wanted to eat with her mother in the kitchen, but it was always determined on whether there was a seat at the table after all the guests were seated. And this reminded me a lot of the way that people think of affirmative action. Our society really doesn't have much qualms about affirmative action, provided that there's an extra seat at the table. The problem with it is that the seat is never ours as another American citizen. And in many ways, the way she was included and excluded sort of identified when she was allowed to be a member, when she was not a member.
When it was convenient and when there was enough extra to go around, essentially.
Exactly. Or when it was, she could she could be like their little pearl that they could hold out of how benevolent they were.
Does she have any fond memories at all of living in that house, or is it all something that she... Because the alternative would have been that she didn't live with her mother at all. She would have had to live with relatives in Mexico.
She loved living with her relatives in Mexico. And, you know, her life would have been completely different, of course, had she done that. But as a baby growing up, she was the center of the attention of her aunts. And it was very difficult when her mother decided to come back, and because her mother at that time was working in El Paso. And Olivia grew up thinking that her aunts were her mother.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very traumatic for her, that move when she was three, to go to Los Angeles with her mother. And her mother was so different from her aunts. She saw her as being very cosmopolitan. But again, you know, these are images and perceptions of her as a child. And she does, you know, reflect back and realize how important it is that she did not end up going back to Mexico, or her mother, although had promised that they would go someday, that they never did, because she would never have been the person she is today or have the kinds of opportunities.
You've gotten the long version of her story in every detail, and so much of it is included in this book. What is the shorthand version of when someone asks her, you know, a new acquaintance about her childhood? What is the shorthand version that she gives them?
She usually just says she grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows enough various places in Los Angeles that she can, you know, hold her own on a conversation. But it's such a complicated story to tell. And one of her qualms of growing up about trying to explain that story was people calling her on whether it was an authentic ethnic or class experience. And it's an awkward situation because she did have the cultural capital of the middle class, but she didn't have the economic capital.
So there are people
who couldn't decide, for instance, her mother didn't have the money to get her teeth, put her in braces as a child,
mm-hmm.
or to do a lot of things.
So are
travel
you,
abroad.
Do you feel like you're finished telling this story? I mean, obviously you remain close to Olivia and Carmen. I mean, is it strange to have this project complete?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm glad that it came into the book, because it's a fascinating read and really presents so many interesting things to think about. Mira Romero is professor and faculty head of justice and social inquiry at Arizona State University. Her book is called The Maid's Daughter, Living Inside and Outside the American Dream. Mary, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing this hour with us.
Thank you for asking me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.